Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Congresswoman Catherine Clark talks about the Democratic agenda and her new leadership role.
It is very exciting to be at the leadership table and not only represent what my constituents are looking for, but help shape the national policy for every American.
And a look ahead at the Patriots' playoff chances after a win on Sunday secured the 2 seed in the AFC and a highly coveted first round bye.
Winning today means we won next week. All right? Yes. So that's... That's what winning today means.
Plus, this New Year's resolution season, how can we keep them?
If you think about what really motivates people, it's not trying to talk ourselves into something. It's what we feel, not what we know.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. President Trump is currently meeting with Republican and Democratic congressional leaders, including Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell, to discuss border security and the prospect of ending the partial government shutdown. Earlier today, Trump continued to push his argument that America needs a wall along its southern border.
We have ICE and we have Border Patrol. They're going to make a plea for the wall. They need the wall. They can't do it without the wall.
This is all happening as the Democrats are preparing to officially claim control of the House of Representatives. And among the leaders of that new congressional majority is Catherine Clark, the representative from Massachusetts's 5th District. Starting tomorrow, she'll serve as vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus, making her the 6th highest ranking member. We spoke earlier this hour, beginning with why she's feeling hopeful about Trump's meeting with congressional leaders.
I'm hopeful that the Trump shutdown can come to an end and that the president will agree to pass the legislation that we are going to take up in the House tomorrow that has already passed the Senate and give us until February 8th to really come to a full compromise. So we will see. It is always interesting negotiating with the president, but I am hopeful that he sees that the shutdown is it's dangerous and it's unfair to the federal workers affected.
So that's the plan you're pushing ahead with. It's spending bills that have already passed the Senate, temporary spending for Homeland Security, and just kick the can a little bit and hopefully make this issue a little easier to deal with in a couple of weeks.
That's right. It will give us some room around Homeland Security, but we'll make sure that the federal workers, the almost 800,000 people that have been affected by the shutdown. And I can tell you that coming through Logan Airport today on my way back to D.C., the TSA agent was from my hometown of Melrose, and he asked me very sincerely to please get his paycheck back to him and how unfair it was. And I take that very seriously, and I'm glad it's going to be the first order of business tomorrow when we are sworn in the majority. And I hope that the president understands that border security is important to everyone in this country and that he cannot hold it for his wall, and that we need to get back to truly negotiating about how we improve national security and protect our federal workers and do what's fair by them.
But the wall does seem to be the real sticking point, at least for the president. He wants $5.7 billion in additional funding to continue construction of a barrier of some kind along the southern border. Do you see an opportunity either this week or, in a couple of months for a compromise on this issue? Maybe he does get the funding for a wall in exchange for the reinstitution of DACA, the Obama-era Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals for people who were brought to the U.S. illegally as children.
Yeah, I think that we are open to compromise, just as you said, but not around a large wall that has never been a realistic plan for improving border security. But we can talk to the president about many things that can improve security on the southern border. Recently, a congressional group traveled to New Mexico and reported that the Border Patrol there did not even have cell service, which is something they need. We can use technology. We can use, as we currently do, some fencing and other types of barriers. I think the only non-starter in all of this is his idea from political rhetoric when he was campaigning that Mexico would build a large wall spanning our entire southern border. We built large walls in medieval times because that was the best technology we had. Today, I can tell you that federal researchers have told me they're far more concerned about tunneling than building walls.
The way you phrase it is the wall is kind of old tech. Nobody talks about E-Verify anymore, but there was this push years ago to say, you know what, we need an electronic border. That is, the reason people are coming to the United States is because there's work. And the reason there's work is because businesses have been getting away with hiring people who are not citizens or not here legally. But we could have an electronic system to monitor business hiring, and that would effectively limit the ability of people coming illegally to get jobs. Why has that sort of fallen off the radar?
Well, I think that this president has become obsessed with this one idea that he has, and that is building a large cement wall. You keep seeing pictures of these prototypes being built, but it's never been realistic. And we have to look at many of the root causes of migration, what is going on in the Honduras and Guatemala and other countries where these migrants and refugees are coming from. How can we be helpful with humanitarian aid? How can we support what is happening in their home countries so that the need to become refugees is diminished? But we're always going to have immigrants, and we have to look at our system and how we can best make sure that the system is one that is fair and that promotes legal immigration.
And presumably it's not just immigration policy or the border that interests you. I mean, we can now let's move to some broader issues. Like you're about to serve. This is your first opportunity to serve in a Democratic majority, right?
Right.
Yeah. And you've taken a leadership role as vice chair of the House Democratic Caucus. So what are you most excited about now that you control you and the Democrats control the House?
Oh, well, I am so excited to put the experiences and the challenges of American families back on the table in Washington. And we saw it throughout the midterms that what people really want to see is that their voices, the things they talk about around their kitchen tables, are represented again and talked about here in Congress. And we're going to start by the first bill we're going to do is going to be aimed at getting corruption out of politics, protecting that fundamental right to vote, making sure we get dark money out of our political campaigns, and put the voice of Americans ahead of special interests.
So, I mean, that's already quite a list of legislative ideas. Lots of them will die before they reach the Senate. This is not necessarily a critique, right? You have a vision, you want to pursue it. Do you feel a sort of mix of optimism and pessimism knowing that control of the House is only one branch of government?
Yeah, we're very aware that the House is the only Democratic majority, and the White House is also Republican. But I think that it is about making that case for the American people that our crumbling infrastructure needs our attention, making health care more affordable, protecting those with pre-existing conditions. So I am very hopeful that when we can actually pass bills through the House, whether it's reforming our gun laws, addressing climate change, that if the Senate or the President rejects those, that that's going to be something the American people are going to have to make a decision on in 2 years, in 2020. But I think there is plenty of room in a bold agenda that is driven by the needs and opportunities of the American people to find bipartisan support.
There are also powers the House has. So, I mean, in addition to kind of legislative maneuvering, there are powers that the House has that don't rely on cooperation with other branches, including investigative powers. How big a role do you see, or how do you balance a legislative agenda against investigating President Trump and other sort of issues of malfeasance that you see across government or more broadly?
Yeah, well, I think that we can do both things. We can absolutely move forward on a bold agenda and hold this administration accountable. Over the last 2 years, we've seen the Republicans really fail to govern and fail to provide oversight. So we are going to be looking at some of the issues that the Republicans just refused to. But I see that as part and parcel of putting together a bold agenda that, you know, really puts the American people first. And I think that we will do both.
So I'm also very concretely interested in the question of President Trump's tax returns. I mean, my understanding is that the House has the unilateral authority to read his tax returns into the public record. Is that right? And are you going to do that?
That is correct. And my understanding from Chairman Richie Neal of Massachusetts, who is the incoming chairman of Ways and Means, is that he will be making a request for the president's tax returns. And we will see what the response will be from the administration when he does that.
Does the administration get to make a response? That is it a request or is it a legal right? Do you have a sense?
Well, I think that there is some concern that the president will bring a lawsuit to try and block the chairman of Ways and Means and that committee from getting those tax. But we will have to see what sort of objection, if any, they put up to turning over those tax returns.
So getting back to sort of the Democratic control and the new majority, you've supported the presumptive House Speaker Nancy Pelosi very publicly since the debate over her speakership began. You've also played a big role helping new Democrats get elected and mentoring them in D.C. You've won some accolades for this. And I wonder if you can keep doing both, hew to the old guard, be a friend to the new guard. Do you feel pulled apart?
Absolutely not. You know, I think that Nancy Pelosi is going to be the type of speaker that we need for these times. She's strategic. She knows the House and Congress so well. She is tough-minded negotiator, but she's also fair. And I think the changes that she and Jim McGovern are proposing that are really going to strengthen our committees again is also going to help with bipartisanship and be able to get Congress functioning as it should. And I am so excited and energized by the new members that we have coming in, many of whom I've worked with over the past 2 years throughout their campaigns. So I am very optimistic about what the House is going to be able to accomplish and couldn't be more excited about what the Democratic caucus looks like and having Nancy Pelosi as speaker.
Well, could I give like a concrete example of where there might be a tension here? I mean, take the Green New Deal, right? A number of incoming congresspeople, among them Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have been calling for a major policy push to invest in clean energy and pair that with a way to create jobs. You know, so create jobs and combat global warming through a Green New Deal. That's the promise. You haven't signed on yet, as I understand it. Neither has the speaker. Isn't that a kind of tension already?
I actually have.
Oh, you have signed on yet. Well, I apologize for mischaracterizing that.
That's okay. And you know, the speaker is supporting the select committee that will be looking at climate change and what a Green New Deal would look like. So I think that, you know, that is a great example of where, you know, the more established senior members of the caucus are working with our new members who are, you know, using their voices and why they got elected to bring shine a spotlight on these issues, and climate change is one of them. So I actually see that as an issue where we are going to be able to work together, and where you see a synergy between our new members and our leadership team.
All right, last question, and you had to know it was coming. On Monday, Senator Elizabeth Warren took a step towards running for president, this little gradual dance where you set up a committee and you don't quite announce. But she did set up an exploratory committee in moving towards a formal run for president. Will you be supporting her?
So we are going to let her process play out, but I can tell you this, that I think the message that Elizabeth Warren has been championing her entire professional life, and certainly as a U.S. Senator from Massachusetts, is one of economic opportunity and making sure that things work as well on Main Street as they do on Wall Street. And I am encouraged and supportive of bringing that discussion and perspective into the presidential race as well.
That's Congresswoman Catherine Clark. She represents Massachusetts' 5th District. Representative Clark, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Evan. Happy New Year.
Stay with us. Coming up, we discuss the new legislative session here on Beacon Hill. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, and we're traveling from Capitol Hill to Beacon Hill because D.C. isn't the only place where lawmakers are entering a new legislative year. Newly elected and reelected state legislators are being sworn in today, and also they're completing their first official act, which is to reelect State House Speaker Robert DeLeo and Senate President Karen Spilka to their leadership posts. WBUR's Steve Brown joins us now from the State House for more on what's expected from Beacon Hill this session. Hi, Steve.
Hey, hi, Evan. How are you?
Oh, I got nervous there for a second. Glad you. How's the State House treating you today?
It's treating me fine. It's nice to be back.
Yeah, well, back is the right term. 2018 was a big year in Massachusetts politics. The minimum wage got increased. We had criminal justice reform, family leave. Is 2019 going to be as impactful a year?
Well, I'm not sure about that. We'll see. We're going to have a lot of periods of inactivity for a while, followed by flurries of brisk action.
It's a weather report for politics in Massachusetts.
It takes a while for all the bills to get sent to the various committees and then for those committees to begin holding the hearings. So a lot of the work that goes on is kind of in the offices and what have you here. We probably won't see any major legislation passed until maybe the fall, with the exception, of course, with the state budget. That pretty much takes up all of the attention in this building right up through the end of June.
And that's not unusual. Our sessions run 2 years. Very often the first year is kind of preparations for that flurry, as you describe it, in the second year.
That's right. Expect it to be very busy July of 2020.
So what about the relationship between the House and the Senate? It has been contentious at times. Do you expect that to continue? Is there any reason to think they'll be able to work together more smoothly this session?
Well, they will manage. This is the first full session with Karen Spilka in the role of Senate President. She took what could be considered a bit of a jab at the House today in her remarks, declaring the time for small ideas and incremental change is over. Now, in recent years, the Senate has wanted to tackle some of the tougher issues, while the House tends to take a more cautious approach. Spilka telegraphed that the Senate intends to continue a bold approach, singling out a desire to address tax reform, education funding, and legislation that would slow the rise of prescription drug prices.
And what about House Speaker DeLeo? He was reelected. Did he also talk about big, bold things?
No, his remarks were a little bit shorter and were more just of a welcoming nature. He's been Speaker for going on 10 years now. He was reelected today to that post overwhelmingly, 119 to 31. Those 31 votes, of course, were the Republicans who voted for the minority leader, Brad Jones. 8 Democrats, including 4 freshmen, voted present. Now, still, there are some private rumblings that maybe DeLeo has had this job too long. Down in the Democratic caucus earlier this morning, some members proposed a motion that would require that in the future the vote for Speaker would be done by a secret ballot. Supporters of that motion contend that doing it that way would shield them from possible retribution should they not vote for the ultimate winner.
A secret ballot vote for the leader, huh?
Well, in the caucus, because everybody has to stand up and declare who they're voting for. And so the thought was, well, hey, you know, that kind of puts the pressure on me. You know, here I'm gonna vote for this other guy, and he might not get in, and what's going to happen to me? So, you know, some of these folks thought that maybe if we do it by secret ballot, kind of like how you vote for your legislators and your governor and your president, you go into a ballot box, nobody knows who you're voting for. They wanted to have the same thing. The motion was soundly defeated, but they did spend about a half an hour discussing it today. I kind of found it interesting.
Well, there are 30 freshman legislators, 25 new state reps, 5 new state senators, bringing new blood in. That sounds like the kind of motion that comes with new blood. What else do you think is in store we can expect to see from these new reps and senators?
Well, that remains to be seen. There has been a lot of turnover in recent years here in the legislature. Some of these freshman reps and senators come up here expecting to change the world, and then they find out that it's not that easy. Many times, as a new rep, the saying goes, you have to go along to get along. Some find that to be the case, and they grow discouraged, and then they'll leave after maybe a term or two. Others find that they can work within the system and work their way up the ladder and gain some clout and get some things passed that is near and dear to themselves and to their constituents.
Well, that's WBUR State House reporter Steve Brown. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thanks, Evan.
Well, don't go anywhere. I gather that sitting next to you at our WBUR State House Bureau is Senate President Karen Spilka. Is that right?
That's right, sitting right next to me.
Can I talk to her?
You sure can.
Fantastic.
Good afternoon.
Hi, President Spilka. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's a big day for you. Congratulations on your reelection, start of a new year, a new legislative session. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling terrific. It was a wonderful ceremony. We have 5 new members that were sworn in today to the Senate, 5 fairly new from last session. We opened up in a newly renovated Senate chamber that goes on only like once in a century. And the Senate chamber is now fully handicapped accessible from front to back. So it's wonderful to open it up to all residents of the Commonwealth.
And also sort of a new era for the Senate. I mean, you took over at a complicated time in the wake of an ethics scandal that led former Senate President Stan Rosenberg to resign. Do you think that turmoil has ended and the Senate is ready to refocus on legislative priorities?
Definitely. I think that we focused on legislative priorities last session. We had a very productive session despite some of the challenges that the Senate saw last session. But we are ready to hit the ground running. There's a lot of excitement over the issues that are ahead of us and the opportunities. We really believe that with the gridlock and inaction to some extent on the federal level, that it presents a tremendous opportunity as well as an obligation to lead on the state level. And Massachusetts has been a leader. We've never shied away from shaking up the status quo in the past, from the Revolutionary War to the fight for equal marriage. And I believe that the Senate is ready, willing, and able to continue that longstanding tradition.
So what's the big revolutionary idea at the top of your list?
Well, there are a lot of issues that you know we need to address. First and foremost is finishing what we came really close to last year with education. Education has always been Massachusetts' lodestar, and we need to ensure that every child has access to a quality public education, no matter where they live or who they are, by passing and fully implementing the Foundation Budget Review Commission's recommendations to make sure they every child does, you know, has the adequate funding. We need to look at health care and make sure that, we came close to finishing last session also. There's a lot of things we could do, and Massachusetts has led the way with health care reform to begin with, and I believe that we can do that again, grab the lead and continue reforming health care to lower costs and make it more accessible and yet still increase the quality. We also have, in this day and age, technology that has radically changed the way that we live and work. And Massachusetts, in true form, has been leading the way in this new landscape, producing entirely new industries fueled by creativity, innovation, and technological expertise. So, and the last thing that the term Commonwealth reminds us that we're invested, all of us are invested in preserving the common good. And we should take a look at our economic development and tax framework to make sure it's in line with the 21st century, where the innovation economy can develop and thrive.
Well, it's quite a long.
Transportation is the last piece. I just want to mention that we really need to commit to developing a transportation infrastructure that matches our 21st century innovation economy.
Well, I was about to say it's quite a long list, and then you added transportation to it, so it's an even longer list. Let's start with ed funding, the education funding. You mentioned the foundation budget, right? This is the formula that makes sure that schools all across the Commonwealth get an amount of money sufficient to provide a quality education to their students. You tried to do this last year and the negotiations broke down. What has changed? What makes last year's failures this year's or this session's successes?
Excuse me. We all know that often it takes several sessions, several years to perfect a bill sufficiently to get it through both the House and the Senate. That's not new. It's happened since I've been here for many years. So we came very close, which so I'm a glass half full type of person. I believe that if anything, that'll help us get it done this session. I believe that there's a will from both the Senate and the House and the administration to make some changes and invest in our education funding formula.
Steve Brown was suggesting in his sort of introduction to this that you had some sharp words for some of your colleagues in their incrementalist approach. I mean, I had sources say to me that the real impediment to some of to progressive change in Massachusetts isn't the Republican governor, it's the House Speaker. Is this your feeling, that sort of collegiality on the among Democrats has broken down in a way that's impeding legislative change?
Not at all. I believe, again, you know, we have 34 Democrats in the Senate. There's, you know, the vast majority of Democrats in the House. We aren't all on the same page for issues, and we will disagree. It's not always Democrat Republican disagreeing, and it's not always, you know, Democrats. We're a big tent, so to speak. You know, people have heard that phrase before. Again, it will take a lot of listening, a lot of working together, collaboration, and communication, and just keep on plugging things through like any other issue. I don't think, you know, the fact that we're all Democrats and having common values and our core values are similar, if anything, I think that'll help us.
Well, I wish you luck in the coming legislative session. That's Massachusetts Senate President Karen Spilka. Thank you so much for joining us, President Spilka.
Thank you so much. Have a great day and Happy New Year.
And to you. It's Wednesday, which means it's time to talk sports. And with snow in the forecast, that means football. Joining us on the line to talk about all things NFL is Ben Volin, NFL reporter for the Boston Globe. Ben, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
No, it's great to have you, and we got lots to talk about. I mean, it was a big weekend in the NFL, you know, figuring out who gets into the playoffs and who's on vacation till August. But we'll start with the Patriots. They won big, I'm sorry to say, against my beleaguered J-E-T-S Jets and get a first-round bye. But how far can they make it? Are they going to the Super Bowl? That's a big one. Are they going to the Super Bowl or not?
So I'd say the chances of them getting to the Super Bowl are less than in the past few years, no question. But from the last 4 years, the Patriots have always kind of been above the pack. They've been the clear favorite. This year, they're right in the middle of the pack. I definitely think
middle of the pack of playoff teams.
I'm sorry?
Middle of the pack of playoff teams.
Yes, of the six AFC playoff teams, I'd say it's kind of wide open this year in the AFC. Realistically, all six of these teams are playing pretty well right now, and you can make a credible case that any of them could make the Super Bowl run. And the Patriots, I definitely see a scenario where they win their divisional game and maybe the Chiefs get upset like they always do and the Patriots end up hosting the AFC championship game and they never have to leave home. Where they've been 8-0 this year. I also see a scenario where maybe the Ravens or the Chargers or even the Texans come in the second round and upset the Patriots at Gillette Stadium. The Patriots have been a very inconsistent team this year, even though they had some two pretty big wins over the Bills and Jets to finish the season. I think there are some issues on offense that could cause some trouble against much better competition in the playoffs. And it's just, you know, it's been a weird season for the Patriots. Tom Brady hasn't looked like himself. Gronk definitely hasn't looked like himself. They've not been a very good road team this year, 3-5 on the road. So, you know, if you had to ask me, are they going to make the Super Bowl, I'd say no. I think this is probably the Chiefs' year. But it's definitely wide open, and there's definitely a road to the Super Bowl for the Patriots.
Well, presumably, if they can walk down that road, it involves Brady playing at his best, which he hasn't always this year. Do you see anything in terms of where he is now? Is he improving? Is he going to show his true colors in the playoffs?
Well, first of all, last week against the Jets, I thought he looked much better just physically, moving around, shuffling in and out of the pocket, buying time, throwing on the run. He's been dealing with a knee injury for a little bit this year, not a major one, and he's played through it, but you know, moving on and throwing on the run and moving around hasn't been his specialty. So I thought that was a good sign from Brady that he's at least getting through whatever little knee injury he was dealing with. And getting this bye, having a second week to prepare and rest up for this game is going to be huge. You know, that said, I think it's also a lot about the people around Tom Brady. I don't think the Patriots have the best talent on offense this year. Julian Edelman has been pretty reliable overall. He's been a nice addition since coming back from his four-game suspension to start the season. James White has been pretty durable and dependable for the Patriots this year, but losing Josh Gordon in week 16 definitely hurt them. He was their most dynamic player, their biggest and most physical player. Gronk clearly has been a shell of himself this year, not the dominant physical player that he once was. Chris Hogan has mostly disappeared this season. Brady, just for one reason or another, isn't throwing him the ball. And I just, you know, you look at the Patriots offense and it's not the well-oiled machine that it has been in years past. So,
but you do mention they get a bye. They did, you know, they did manage to do well enough that they get this week off, maybe time to regroup, recover from whatever injuries they have, think about becoming the playoff team they want to become.
Yeah, I mean, definitely playing at home is huge, getting the bye is huge, but you know, you can't just snap your fingers and expect the offense to be clicking on all cylinders. Like, they do have some issues that they look great against the Bills and the Jets, but I want to see how they would look against the Ravens or the Chargers or even the Texans. Those are three very good teams who have all proven they can go on the road and win, and they have excellent defenses, and the Patriots' offense does have some issues. So, yes, of course, we all believe in Tom Brady, and if you're going to bet on any quarterback, it's him. But the Patriots' roster has some significant issues this year that they haven't had in the past.
Okay, let's take a step back. Take a step back and look at diversity issues across the league, because it was not just a big weekend on the field, it was a big weekend off the field. Black Monday, a time of the year when coaches whose teams haven't done very well get fired. Four black coaches got fired Sunday and Monday, meaning that five of the eight coaches fired this year were black head coaches in the NFL. Is there a deeper issue here?
So, interestingly, yesterday I called the founder of the Fritz Pollard Alliance. They're an advocacy group for minority coaches. They are not part of the NFL. They're separate from the NFL, but they worked with the league to come up with the Rooney Rule back in 2003, which requires teams to interview minority candidates for all head coaching and general manager positions.
So they've been instrumental in helping pushing the league forward, making sure the league is attentive to these kinds of issues.
Yes, definitely. So I called the founder of the Fritz Pollard Alliance, Cyrus Mary, who takes the issue of diversity obviously very seriously. And he told me, look, the fact that five African-American coaches were fired this year, it's the nature of the NFL. It's the fact that it's a results-based business, and none of the five coaches had good results, and frankly, their performance, you know, probably didn't merit them keeping their jobs. And Cyrus said he's not concerned about diversity in the NFL right now, or at least he's very pleased with the way things are headed and optimistic about where it's headed, where a lot of minorities now are starting to get interviews with for GM and every head coaching opportunity. And they've tightened up some of the loopholes in the rule, and certainly the NFL for years, teams would do these sham interviews, but the NFL is getting more serious about it, and they've tightened that up, and there are no more sham interviews. It all has to be done seriously, and I think it's exposing owners and teams to a broader range of candidates that they hadn't seen in the past. Now, the bigger issue is the fact that quarterbacks coaches and offensive coordinators have very few minorities. There was only two offensive coordinators and two quarterback coaches who were minorities this past year, and one of them was the same person, Byron Leftwich in Arizona, and those are the positions that are overwhelmingly represented as head coaches. So there's still definitely a need to get more quarterback coaches and offensive coordinators for people in minorities, but I'd say the league overall is still doing a pretty good job for diversity with the head coaching ranks.
Yeah, but it's not just head coaching, right? It's also front office positions, general managers. Are they doing as well there?
Well, right now there's only one minority, or there will be soon. The Ravens, Ozzie Newsome, is retiring after the year, and the Raiders fired their general manager, Reggie McKenzie. So Chris Greer, a Holliston, Mass native, he's the only minority GM pretty soon. He's with the Dolphins. Certainly there could be better representation there, but the Rooney Rule does apply for that, and there will be minority interviews for any openings that come up. I'm definitely not saying it's perfect, but the NFL is at least getting more serious about diversity, and certainly in the coaching ranks, I think you're starting to see some of that.
Circle back to the Patriots for our last question then. Any chance someone on the Patriots coaching staff could be poached by other teams? Obviously, there are a lot of vacancies now.
Yeah, there are the two coordinators. Josh McDaniels, the offensive coordinator, is lining up interviews for this weekend. And Brian Flores, the defensive coordinator, another minority candidate, he's got four or five interviews lined up for this weekend. He had his first head coaching interview last year with the Cardinals. I was told they were actually pretty blown away by Flores, but felt he wasn't quite ready to be a head coach. I wouldn't be surprised if he gets an offer this time. I think he's a energetic, dynamic young coach, and some teams are looking for a guy like that to re-energize the team and bring some juice to their locker room. I think Flores could go, and Josh McDaniels is absolutely a candidate too. So I see a possibility where both coordinators leave the Patriots this offseason.
That's Ben Volen, NFL reporter for the Boston Globe. Ben, thanks so much for being with us, helping us understand what's going on in the NFL.
All right, thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, want to keep your New Year's resolution? Try more gratitude. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Finally today, New Year's resolutions. I know you made them, even if you haven't admitted it to your friends, your spouses. Eat healthier, exercise more, be more patient. Well, according to Northeastern University professor of psychology David DeSteno, a quarter of those resolutions will be broken by next week. DeSteno joined Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks last year at this time to offer his advice on how to do better. His big tip? Practice gratitude.
The tip here is this connection between things like compassion and gratitude and keeping New Year's resolutions. This is really intriguing. Explain a little bit about this.
Sure. Well, if you look at most of the bestsellers on your local bookshelves, what you'll see is that they talk about trying to keep our resolutions. And in fact, keeping New Year's resolutions is kind of the problem of life in general, that is trying to reach all of our long-term goals and stick to them. The way we have to do it is to kind of have grit and force ourselves through logic and willpower,
right,
to keep to our goals. And as you just cited in those statistics, it tends not to work that well. On any given day, one out of every five times we try to resist a temptation, we fail. And I think it's because we're using the wrong tools. If you think about what really motivates people, it's not trying to talk ourselves into something. It's what we feel, not what we know. And we're kind of ignoring our emotions. Sure, there are emotions that got kind of a bad rap that make us want to take the easy way out or give into a desire. But there are other emotions that make us willing to sacrifice for other people for the long term. Things like gratitude and compassion. And what we're finding is they also not only make you willing to sacrifice to help other people, but also to help your own future self.
See, this is really intriguing. So this idea, so make the connection. I mean, let's talk about a sort of typical kind of resolution. You know,
sure.
I want to, and I always think about it in terms of willpower and grit. You know, I want to get up every other day and go to the gym. I want to go at least 3 times a week, right?
Mm-hmm.
A good week will be 4, and you know, the week that I'm aiming for is 3 times a week. How is sort of having gratitude, being compassionate, those sort of social emotions mm-hmm. going to help me do that?
So let me give you an example. What we find in general is that the more often people feel these states, the more their mind is willing to value the future and to accept short-term sacrifice. So I'll give you an example. We did it with finances instead of going to the gym, but
yeah.
The same logic applies. So we'll bring people in and we'll ask them questions. You know, would you rather have X dollars now or Y dollars in Z days, where Y is always more than X and Z varies over weeks to months? And what you'll see is most people are pretty impatient. We find on average that, you know, people, if I give you $17 now, you'll forego getting $100 in a year, even though that makes little sense unless you need that $17 to survive, given what the banks are paying.
Mm.
If you make people feel grateful, they don't discount the value of the future as much. What they do is they value it more. And so these people who are feeling grateful, not happy, not good, but grateful or compassionate or proud, they require double the amount. It doubles their willpower. They require over $30 to give in. And what that suggests, right, it's kind of like the marshmallow test for adults. People know Walter Mischel's marshmallow test. It increases your patience. And what we find and others find is that the more often you feel grateful or gratitude or compassion in life, it's tied to better academic performance, better exercise, eating healthily, not giving into junk food, lower levels of consumerism, impulsivity, and addictive behaviors. And they're kind of like a booster shot, right? These emotions make us willing to sacrifice in the moment to forestall an immediate pleasure for some future gain.
You made reference to the marshmallow test. I'm not sure everybody would know that. So explain what that is, because you described a sort of updated version of the marshmallow
exactly.
test, right?
So this is a famous set of studies, and justifiably so, done by a psychologist named Walter Mischel in the 1970s. And he would bring children in, and he would put down a marshmallow or other sweet in front of one and say, okay, you can eat this now, but I've got to go do something. If you wait 15 minutes till I get back, you can have a second. And then he watched what happened. And what you can see is some kids gobble it up and some kids can wait. And what he tied this to over time is the kids who had better self-control were able over time to have better academic performance, better financial performance as adults, all good things. And since that time, Angela Duckworth has tied grit to similar outcomes. We did the same experiment, but with cash, because most adults like cash more than marshmallows. And what we found is if you make people feel grateful, and other people have done it with pride, their patience increases. And it's not because they have more willpower. It's because they discount the value of the future less, or they value it more. And it becomes easier to persevere toward it. It's less stressful. It takes less of a toll on your body and on your well-being.
Interesting. What are the sort of evolutionary underpinnings of this thinking? I mean, why? I mean, you sort of know intuitively that it's good to be patient, it's good to save for the future, but is there a real sort of evolutionary logic to this?
Yeah, there is, and you're raising an important point. I mean, if you think about it, the goals we have today to max out our 401k or to complete the whole 30 didn't matter much for most of our evolutionary history. They didn't even exist, right? For millennia, what mattered was the ability to form strong cooperative relationships, people that you could count on and would count on you. To do that, you had to be a moral person. You had to be generous. You had to be compassionate and show empathy. You had to be honest. You basically had to have a good character. That's where self-control came from originally. And these are the emotions that underlie those behaviors. And so now, by feeling these emotions, yes, they make us willing to sacrifice other people by making us value the future more than the present, but they also make us willing to sacrifice for our own individual goals, things that in modern life are more tied to success. But because they're socially based, they also solve another big problem. You know, one of the big plagues of modern life now is loneliness. If you look at the stats, you know, the number of people who say that they have at least one friend they can rely on dropped dramatically from, you know, 80% in 1985 to 57% today. 53% of people today report that they're lonely at work. What these emotions do is they, by making us behave in ways that show care and sacrifice for others, they draw others to us. They kind of solve that dichotomy that David Brooks talks about between resume virtues, those virtues that are related to maximizing your career outcomes, and eulogy ones, those that you want to be remembered for. And so what they do is build a social network for you that will help you when you do fall. At the same time, they're helping you have more perseverance and grit.
So it's a simple idea. I mean, if you're someone who exudes gratitude, if you're compassionate with other people, people are going to be drawn to you. I mean, that's sort of the message.
They will be drawn to you, but yeah, at the same time, they are a booster shot for your own self-control.
Interesting. It's funny because it sort of runs counter to, you know, when you think of some examples of what it means or what it takes to be successful at work, it's this idea of being tough and sort of damn the torpedoes, move forward. Yeah. But this is sort of advocating another approach.
It is advocating another approach. And I think the problem is the approach we're taking for success in modern life is kind of exactly what you're saying. And it can lead people to kind of an atomistic, isolated existence. It's nose to the grindstone. I'm not caring about anybody else. And that takes a toll over time. You know, there's work by a psychologist at Northwestern, Greg Miller, who looked at kids from disadvantaged backgrounds who had higher self-control and were performing better. Yes, they performed better, but exerting that level of self-control took a toll on their health. Over time, it hurt their immunity and other things.
Ah.
Whereas, because you're always in a struggle, you're trying to repress
right,
a desire.
And self-denial, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But feeling these emotions, having compassion for yourself, you know, working hard, yes, taking pride in your own abilities, having gratitude, they're tied to lower blood pressure, to better immunity. They're kind of a balm to the body, whereas, you know, the stress of arguing with yourself and criticizing yourself is the opposite.
So how do we practice? I mean, what's the best way to sort of practice these social emotions like gratitude and compassion?
There are a few different ways. For gratitude, one thing that I recommend is simply doing a gratitude diary or a gratitude journal. The trick to that is, you know, we all have the two or three things that we're immensely grateful for in life. If you think about those same things every day, they're going to lose their power. So rather, what we've found that works is simply think about things from your day. You know, did somebody let you in on the expressway? Did somebody stop and help you and give you directions? Did somebody hold the door for you? Those little things work just as well. For compassion, it's trying to put yourselves in other people's shoes and have empathy for them. It's also showing yourself compassion. And we've also found in other work we do is mindfulness and meditation practice is very powerful in increasing compassion. And pride, it's celebrating your own baby steps, you know, your victories along the way, as opposed to just waiting for the end. Those types of things on a daily basis will just reinforce your ability to persevere and do it in a way that feels comfortable and energizing as opposed to critical and draining.
You have a new book, Emotional Success, The Power of Gratitude, Compassion, and Pride. You talk about how these emotions can affect not just an individual, but society as a whole, right?
Yeah. So at the end, I do. I mean, the problem of valuing the future more than the present is a problem that America is not doing very well at. I mean, we have a budget deficit that's out of control. We have crumbling infrastructure and lots of other problems. And what all these stem from is a refusal to do what's necessary in the moment, to sacrifice in the moment for the long term. You know, most of Congress wants to operate on the idea of not in my own fiscal term. Yes, doing these things is good, but if I do it right now, I'm going to suffer with the voters. But what we see is that, you know, I'll give you one example. You know, countries like Denmark that teach compassion and empathy as part of their early curriculum in terms of education early on, show a greater willingness to sacrifice, accept sacrifices in the moment in terms of accepting energy costs to have clear energy, et cetera, and infrastructure than we do in the United States. And it's hard to draw a one-to-one comparison there, but given the work we're looking at in the lab that show us that people are willing to make these sacrifices, I think fostering these emotions at a societal level will not only give us a more peaceful and ethical existence here, but will also, I think, help our policies be more future-oriented.
That was David DeSteno, professor of psychology at Northeastern University and author of the book Emotional Success, The Power of Gratitude, Compassion, and Pride. He joined Radio Boston's Anthony Brooks in January of last year. And he's made me think perhaps I should make a new resolution of my own, or several of them. Read that book. Practice gratitude. Listen to some back episodes of Radio Boston. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.